Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, it's the time of the year that used to get Lee all of a fluster. But is there much about ISIS season anymore to turn his little cheeks ruddy again? Yes, say the team. So we'll be discussing falling back in love with the ISA, the different types, where you can get the best rates, and some tips for investing, whatever your level of confidence. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But firstly, Lee, I'm unsurprisingly going to go to you first on this, because regular listeners, and when I say regular listeners, I mean those who've been with us for the full 7 years plus. I used to joke, Lee, in the early days, that you would get so excited. Your cheeks did go a little bit rouge when you started talking about ISIS. Why? Why do personal finance journalists get so excited at this time of the year, especially when you think about things like the personal savings allowance, rubbish rates, etc.? Are they worth getting excited about anymore?
Well, Georgia, I would say that over those 7 years, I've mellowed somewhat over ISIS, I'm afraid. Yeah, I used to do like a top five countdown of like the best rates. And between March and May, we used to have banks, building societies all clamber over each other to offer best buy cash ISA rates and rake in some money. And reason why personal finance journalists, get so excited about this is a twofold thing, really. Firstly, it's actually a good product. You know, it's a rare thing. I would say it's great to be able to save tax-free. It's great to be able to shelter your money from the tax man. But secondly, our readers care. You know, people wanted to read about what the best rates were, where money should go and all that kind of thing. Now, we can say cash ISA season is definitely a dead duck. It's done. And actually, in the last 6 months of last year, there was a record exodus of cash ISA money, almost 5 billion quid, according to Bank of England stats. So it shows you that there's cash ISAs.
Where was that money going? Do we know, Lee?
Well, this is it. Yeah. So there has been a massive boon in stocks and shares investing. And actually, what I was about to say there is there is an ISA season now, but the ISA season has shifted away from cash and it's shifted into the emphasis of stocks and shares ISAs in the fact that there's a lot of platforms heavily advertising this year. I would say far more than ever before. I've seen TV adverts for Hargreaves, Vanguard, and their stocks and shares ISAs. So there is an ISA season. It's just shifted over to stocks and shares. And I think more people are getting tempted into that. And you can see why, because at the moment it is difficult to get 0.5% on return. But you talked there about a personal savings allowance, which came in 5 years ago. And for a basic rate taxpayer, it means you can earn £1,000 of interest tax-free. For higher rate taxpayers, it's £500. But if you maximize this, if you use this facility to its full potential in ISA, you all know at the moment it's very difficult to earn interest that's going to tick you over that amount. If you have built up a pot, you will tick over that amount. And the personal savings allowance is far more likely to get removed or get tinkered with in the future, I would argue, than the whole ISA system that's been, you know, in its current form for over 20 years. And people have saved prudently into these products, Georgie. And, you know, I still think it's worth having. Now, is it worth having a cash ISA or is it worth having a stocks and shares ISA? That's down to your individual circumstances. It might even be worth having a blend of the two, which we'll discuss, I guess, further in this podcast. But there is still a point of ISA saving, and I still do get excited about ISAs. I think they're a really good product. I do.
ISAs are great. I'm a great proponent of the ISA. Basically, if you're going to get paid a lousy interest rate on your savings, it's better to get a lousy interest rate tax-free than to be paid a lousy interest rate and then get taxed on it. And investing-wise, there are no capital gains taxes to pay. There's no dividend tax to pay. You won't pay money when you cash in your investments and take some money out to spend it or do whatever. It's a fabulous way of investing, and there's also no tax forms to fill in. You don't have to worry about any of that stuff. You just do it in an ISA, and I've waxed lyrical about them before. But if you are going to invest, and there is the option to invest within an ISA, definitely do it within an ISA. Unless you're investing in your pension instead, which is a completely different matter. If you're talking about literally the most tax-efficient thing that you can do, putting money into a pension comes near the top of the pile because you get tax relief on it. You get automatic basic rate tax relief, which bumps up what you put in by 25% to take you to before the point that you pay 20% basic rate tax. the maths works that it's 25% because you have to go up by 25% to get back to where you started. If you're a higher rate taxpayer, you can then get additional benefits on top of that. And then you start having those removed from you once you're a really high earner. But the problem with a pension is also the great blessing of a pension in that you can't get the money out of it before a certain point. Mm. So it's 57, it's going to be 60 for a lot of people, I would suggest. It's 55, it's going to 57, it's going to be 60 for a lot of people. Now that's great because that's your retirement fund and it means you can't spend it before then. It's not so good in if you need the money or whatever. So I think a blend of the two is good. Personally, I've got my money that goes into my company pension. And every year I maybe put a little bit extra into a pension, but the rest of the money that I'm saving on a monthly basis goes into an investment ISA because I've already got a rainy day fund in cash. I'm not saving for anything short term. If I was saving something short term, I wouldn't necessarily invest the money. And the rest of it's just kind of long-term wealth building. And I think a lot of people see it that way, but you don't have to be rich to invest. You can invest £25 a month. You need to make sure you've got a rainy day fund first in cash and that this isn't short-term money that you're going to need and that it's going to be an issue if you go to take it out and it's the stock market's fallen, you know, 20% or something. But once you've got that, you can start investing and you can do it for a very, very low cost. You can put in a very small lump sum or you could invest £25 a month just to get started.
I wonder, in terms of cash ISAs and easy access, I imagine, a good place to have your rainy day fund as opposed to a savings account? I mean, is that why you'd use it? I interviewed someone recently who had £50,000 in a cash ISA. The first thing the financial advisor said was, well, you barely have anything in your pension. What is it doing sat there in your cash ISA?
I wouldn't necessarily say that having a cash ISA is the best place for your rainy day fund. And the reason why I say that is cash ISA rates tend to be a little bit lower than what traditional accounts are. The reason for that is there's not as much competition. It's a bit more red tape, especially for challenger banks to set up an ISA over just a regular fixed rate savings account that doesn't do that. With rates so low, it's very unlikely that you're going to tick over that personal savings allowance at the moment with your rainy day fund. That said, there has been a bit of movement in the cash ISA world this week. We've actually seen Nationwide launch an ISA. Now, the reason why I'm saying this is because at the start of the show, you said about me getting excited about ISA season and all that kind of stuff and the rates that used to be on offer and all of the banks scrambling over each other. Nationwide actually have launched an 18-month bond at 0.75%, a cash ISA. Now you go, cool, that's 0.75%. However, if you've got 10 grand, you get a 50 quid bonus, which actually bumps that rate over to over 1%. Now, I can't believe I'm sitting here and having to give a trick away about getting more than 1% on a savings account or a cash ISA. But that is the kind of savings world we're now in. This time last year, when we did this podcast, it's likely that you would have been able to get 1% on an ISA, cash ISA, relatively easily. But now you're having to jump through hoops. You have to be an existing Nationwide customer to get that. But it's just a little chink of light that there is a rainy day fund possibility savings account out there that's in a cash ISA wrapper, but they're very few and far between. And I don't know how long it's going to be until rates recover. And it's very, very difficult at the moment to even beat the current rate of inflation, which is 0.7%. See, I mean, that is crazy. In my mind, that is crazy.
I'm listening to you both, Lee, and I'm thinking, all right, yeah, stocks and shares, and we'll get on to how to invest properly in those in a short while, but I can get that, but cash ISAs, I'm like, I'm not sold.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are in that boat at the moment, George, and that's probably why there has been such an exodus of money out of cash ISAs, because people are just thinking, what is the point of getting this really low rate? And we have just come off the back of 12 months where we've had this whole thing about accidental savers. Now, not all people have been able to build up a cash reserve, but a lot of people actually have. I think there's figures showing that something like there's 6 million accidental savers in Britain from the last year who've saved on things like commuting costs and not being able to go on holidays, all of that kind of stuff. And they've managed to build up a bit of a savings buffer. Something like 150 to 200 billion pounds has been saved this way from these accidental savers. Now, I think there's a reason why this money hasn't been directed into cash ISAs. I think a lot of it, again, there was figures suggesting that something like 70% of it is just being held in current accounts, which is a worse option than a cash ISA. At least a cash ISA is going to offer you a little bit of interest. At least a cash ISA is going to offer you a segregated account where you're not going to be tempted to spend it when it's all just absorbed into your current account. But I can totally see the point of why people are probably at the moment thinking, no, what's the point of a cash ISA? And actually getting more interested in a stocks and shares alternative because of a potential of higher rates that are on return for people. Perhaps that is what's happening. I think that is a trend that we're seeing more and more, especially this year.
All right, Simon. Well, I want to then delve into that. If you are one of these newbie investors in a stocks and shares ISA, how do you go about doing it properly? And how then do you kind of gear it up a little bit so you can go pro in the end? But for the starters, for the newbies, what should you be thinking about?
Well, firstly, I'd think about, why do you want to invest? And is it right for you? So as I said before, rainy day money, short-term money, that needs to be held safely in cash. And once you've done that, you think, okay, do I want to try and get a better return on my money? Why would you get a better return on your money from investing? Well, it's not guaranteed for a start. You can't take past performances as a guarantee of future returns. However, the ability of companies to take money and put it to productive use and therefore generate profits is what drives long-term returns from the stock market. It's a really long run of data that shows that the best chance that you have got of beating inflation is investing in the stock market. Mm-hmm. So that's the why, okay? Then you have to come down to the how. And the how is, you need to go, right, how much money do I have to invest once I've got my safe rainy day fund stashed over there? And do I need to add anything to that each month? So you might have a lump sum. You might have a big lump sum. You might have a small lump sum. You might not have a lump sum at all. You might just have some money to invest each month. But sit down, work it out. It doesn't have to be particularly long. You can do it on the back of an envelope. Once you've done that, you need to have a think about how much risk you're willing to take, okay? And this is a question that people find difficult to get their head around. But ultimately, it boils down to the fact that one day when you open your account, you might find there's less money that you put in there. Or you might find that you were up a lot and now you're not up a lot anymore, that you're down. There's still more than you put in, but you're down 20% on where you were maybe a couple of days before. How are you going to feel when that happens? If you're going to feel really, really, really awful and beat yourself up about it and you can't handle the idea of it, then you are a cautious investor. You can still invest, but you need to be a cautious investor. If your view is the complete opposite, it's like, well, this is a long-term game. I'm investing for the next 10 years. Stuff goes up, stuff goes down. I think that that's totally fine because I think over the long term, I'll win out. And if I open my account one day and it's down 20%, I'll take it on the chin. I'll move on. I'm not going to take the money out that day anyway. Then you are an adventurous investor and you could maybe be 100% in shares. And you don't have to think too much about this, but there are some tools that can help you out. If you go to some of the robo-advisors, which are these platforms that will basically take your money and invest it for you, a lot of them have risk assessing tools and they're free to use. You might have to put your email in and sign up. You don't actually have to pay some money in to use them. Some examples are Nutmeg, Money Farm, Wealthify. So try some of those kind of risk modeling tools. The how then is, do you want somebody to manage your money for you? So you probably might not be able to afford a financial advisor or wealth manager. So we're talking about doing it yourself here, okay? So you might want someone to do it for you, in which case you might want to go for one of those robo-advisors. Or you might think, actually, I'd rather pick the stuff myself, in which case you want a DIY investing platform. And we've got a roundup that looks at the best of those. thisismoney.co.uk/platforms. If you go there, you'll find the details. They all charge like different amounts, different for different people. Have a look at them, choose the one you want. Then it's the what. What do I invest in? And this is the point where a lot of people fall down. They open an account and then they have to choose what they're actually going to invest in. And there's an awful lot of stuff to choose from. I mean, there's the whole stock market, but even if you decide that you're not going to invest directly into individual shares, and you're going to go for funds or investment trusts instead, you then have to decide whether you want an active fund. So there's a manager trying to pick the best investments and they might beat the market or they might fall behind it. Or you want to go for a passive tracker fund where you just follow the stock market. You won't beat it, but you just follow it. And then you have to narrow the choice down. And people worry. People worry not necessarily about picking the best investment. They worry about picking a bad one and getting it wrong. It's loss aversion. So the simplest thing to do is to go for a global fund, one that just invests all around the world. And the simplest thing to do in that instance is to go for a global tracker fund, which isn't trying to beat the market. And if you choose a good one of these, it will be low cost. You put your money into it. You're just backing the companies around the world and their ability to make money. Or you might want to go for an active global fund. There's a few of them that are very popular. And I've written an article this week where I've highlighted some of the passive ones and some of the active ones as well. You also need to think a little bit about asset allocation and risk. Okay, again, asset allocation, boring. What does that mean? Really simple. Don't put all your eggs in one basket. Diversification. So that means not just investing in one share, but it also means maybe not just investing in shares alone. The idea is that if you invest, there are three main assets: shares, bonds, cash. There's other assets as well, but these are the three easy ones. Okay. Shares, you are taking a higher risk for the potential of a greater reward because you have a stake in a company. And if a company does well or is suddenly viewed by the market as doing really well, then it could go up substantially. Likewise, it could fall substantially. You're not really protected in any way. With bonds, you've lent a government or a company some money and they are beholden to pay that back to you and pay you the interest rate return that they have promised unless they go bust. But you're unlikely to make the same returns that you would do on shares. You can do on some bonds, but you know. Cash, that's the safest thing. It's money in the bank. You've been told what interest rate you're going to get. If you've got it in an FSCS protected account, it's protected up to £85,000 per individual bank, but the returns are going to be low. And if you think about it, what you want to do is balance those things together based on how much risk you want to take. So the standard medium level thing has always been 60% shares, 40% bonds. The idea behind that is that the prices of these two things tend to move in opposite directions. So if the stock market rises, bonds don't do so well. But if the stock market tumbles, bonds do quite well. And one sort of drags up the other and balances it out. The problem is bonds are very, very expensive at the moment and have very, very low interest rates. So there's some questions as to whether this still holds, but it's still the simple thing to do. But the other thing you could do is just hold some cash. That's the easy thing. That's the thing that's really easy for people to get their head around. Basically, take some cash and think of that as part of your investment portfolio instead of part of your savings and go, right, I'm going to do 80% shares, 20% cash and see how I go. Or I'm going to start 60% shares, 40% cash. And if I then get a bit comfortable with it, maybe I'll up the shares and downgrade the cash. You're not going to get the same effect where the cash goes up more when the market crashes as you do with bonds, but it's dead easy and it's dead simple to understand for most people. The alternative is to pick something like a Vanguard Life Strategy Fund, which does all of this for you, invests around the world in shares and some bonds, and you can choose different amounts in shares and bonds, and then you're outsourcing the job to someone else. Hopefully that was simple enough, but really it's just about getting started. And actually, yeah, if you're only investing a relatively small amount, or you're only investing a small amount every month, you probably don't need to worry with the bond stuff. Just hold a bit of cash anyway and just invest into a global tracker fund. It's as simple as that.
I think that's important to remember as well, because a lot of the things that put people off, a lot of the reasons that people are put off is, I don't have enough money to invest. Well, you don't need that much money to invest each month, put a little bit aside. And also, I don't feel confident picking and choosing shares, but you can outsource that. I just want to know, if you do want to kind of crank it up, you know, do what the pros do. I'm not suggesting you go pro. How do you do that in a stocks and shares ISA?
Because you can literally invest in a whole world of stuff in an ISA. You've got all of the shares on the stock market, on the UK stock market. You've got all of the funds that are on offer. You've got all of the investment trusts. You've got loads of ETFs that you can invest in, and you could invest in anything from the biggest investment trust at the moment, Scottish Mortgage, invests in some of the world's most exciting companies, growth companies. Tesla, Amazon, Alibaba, Tencent, and some unlisted companies as well, have been hugely successful. Or you could go invest in nice, stable, dividend-paying companies from the UK. City of London Investment Trust has been raising its dividend for 54 years. It was revealed this week. It's a dividend hero, it's so-called. or you could invest just in a fund that picks what it thinks are the world's best companies. For example, the Linsell Train Global Fund or Fundsmith. there's all kinds of things you could invest in, or you can invest in something that invests in renewable energy or things that are going to try to solve the world's environmental problems, or in small UK companies. There's all kinds of things that you can invest in. And if you're an experienced investor, you can do all of that stuff within an ISA and not worry about any of the tax elements, which is a great thing to do. But to you know, but for most people, the simplest thing is like start with the big, broad, easy thing, the global fund. And then if you get interested, maybe add some other stuff. Make that the core of what you're doing. And then maybe add a little bit of stuff around the edges if you get interested. And then if you don't get interested, just keep doing that and keep going and keep going and keep going and keep going. And probably in, you know, a decade, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years time, you'll turn around and think, I'm glad I did that, because I've definitely got more money than if I had left it in that savings account that my bank had just annoyed me by writing to me and telling me they were going to pay me 0.01% on.
Yep. I rather like the idea of our listeners in 40 years time looking back and thinking, God, I'm so glad I listened to that guy. What was his name on the podcast?
Also, to go back to one of these things about kind of losses and loss aversion, people worry about this. There are other things that people do in life where they are guaranteed massive losses and they don't think twice about it. If you buy a brand new car, you are spending tens of thousands of pounds on that car if you buy it outright. If you don't buy it outright and you buy it on finance, which is what most people are doing, you are doing the equivalent, but you are basically funding the depreciation over the first 3 years of the car's life, for example. If you buy a brand new car, you are guaranteed to lose 30% of that value pretty much over the first 3 years of that car's life. Yet at the same time, they say, I wouldn't invest because it's too much of a gamble and I don't want to lose my money. So they're happy to buy a brand new car and lose 30% in 3 years rather than buying a three-year-old car and have someone else lose the money for them. But they'll keep all their money in cash and won't invest. So it's things like that. Whereas if you've worked out you've got £200 a month spare and you've got your rainy day fund and you're going to invest that, if you just invest that £200 every single month, now that's quite a lot of money. It's a meaningful sum of money to people. But you can only lose what you're putting in. Over the long term, it'll probably go up. And yeah, you might turn around. It might be like last year where the stock market crashes and you turn around, you're down 30%. But then all of a sudden, lo and behold, it goes back up. You know, you can't predict these kind of things. But you'd lose more money on a brand new car.
Yeah.
You know, you could, if it's a relatively small amount, then you can afford to take that risk, is what I would say.
It's weird, isn't it, that we're really irrational in some regards, but not in others. Talking of irrational in cars, Simon, I have to have a bit of an aside here and say I was in a Porsche Taycan the other day.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
You lucky, lucky, lucky lady.
Wow. Oh, my God. Sorry, Lee. I know you're still there and we want to talk about lices and jices and all that sort of thing, but the Porsche Taycan, well, my God, when it goes from like zero to whatever it goes to in this legal speed limit, oh, your head goes right back. It's
like hyperspeed,
yeah,
isn't it? Yeah. Oof. And an electric car feels faster the from standstill acceleration than a petrol driven car, because the power is driven, goes straight from the motors to the wheels in a way that it doesn't in a petrol driven car. So, you know, something like a very fast Tesla or a Porsche Taycan or something will feel considerably faster than the same kind of petrol driven car.
I mean, it was good, but it's not a Vauxhall Mokka, is it? I mean, really. Lee, we digress. We're going to talk about the other members of the ISA, or some of the other members, the baby, the JISA, the junior ISA, and the, I don't know, teenager, the lifetime ISA. Firstly, the junior ISA. £9,000. That's generous.
Yeah, that's the new limit that came in last year, Georgie, more than doubled. So now you can put enough money away for your child to get a Porsche in the future if you start early enough. So a junior ISA, they're a good product. £9,000 now, I think, is quite a big sum for people to be able to tuck away for their children, for their grandchildren. I've always argued that, you know, you should save for your child's future, and you can listen to Podcast Pass where just shortly after my daughter was born, I was talking about how I was investing for her future and what I wanted to do by the time she was 18. So with a junior ISA, they're not actually as popular as you think they would be. There's just under 1 million accounts and there's about £5 billion in them, but there's about 12 million kids that are missing out on junior ISA cash, potentially savings where people haven't opened accounts for them. And people might have other savings plans for them and that kind of thing. But there's two options for your junior ISA. So again, you can have an investing version or you can have a cash ISA. Now, the cash version actually for children's accounts, way, way, way better than they are for adult accounts. The rates on offer are much better. For example, Coventry Building Society at the moment has 2.95% on offer, and you can open an account from as little as £1. So I think sometimes people think, oh, you know, it's difficult to save for their children. You know, children are expensive. They are. But even if you tuck away a little bit of money each month rather than buying an extra toy or whatever, you know, there will be a meaningful sum come, you know, by the time they reach adulthood. And in investment version, the argument is you can take way more risk because, especially if you open it on day dot when your child's born, that's 18 years potentially of investment growth. And you are going to be riding out all kinds of storms, but also highs and all that kind of stuff. So over the long term, what I would suggest is just having a look at a compound calculator, having a look at sort of what would happen if you got a 3% return, a 5% return, or an 8% return over all of those years. You need to look into the fees, as you do for any stocks to shares ISA, and make sure you're not getting sizable fees eating away at your money. But there is one big key thing about a junior ISA that people should definitely know, and that is that children get access to it at 16. And they can manage it from 16 and then they can get access to it from 18. It is their money. You can't do anything about it. You can't touch it. And actually, again, I've spoken about this in podcasts past, but I actually saved my daughter inside my own ISA wrapper for that reason, because I basically want to save money for her to do things like, I'm thinking about when she turns 18 and wants driving lessons or wants to go to university or, you know, hopefully, or any of those kind of things that I can just be like, I've got a bit of money here that I can kind of do those things for her. And that's kind of my aim for my own daughter for saving. And that's why I use my own allowance than the junior ISA allowance, because I would never breach £20,000 a year ever, if I'm being quite frank. So that's why I do that. There's lots of things to consider, but I would definitely say, you know, look at your options and just get saving for your children. It doesn't matter how much it is. It is well worth doing. And then I'll get on to the lifetime ISA. Now, I've been a bit of a critic of the lifetime ISA, mainly because it encourages putting money away for two completely separate goals, buying a home and for a retirement fund. Now, if you're going to use it specifically for buying a home, it's great. If you know you're going to buy a home with the money in the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years, it's absolutely fine. You can put £4,000 in, you're going to get £1,000 bonus. Where else are you going to get a guaranteed 25% return on your money, right? So it's a kind of no-brainer if you know you're going to use it for a home. At the moment, there is this kind of thing at the moment, though, that if you need access to that money, you're going to get, at the moment, you won't get penalized. So you will lose the government bonus, but you won't lose any of the money that you put in. But from April again, from the new tax year, it's reverting back to old rules. These rules were brought in for the pandemic, right? So people could access their money without penalty. It took some campaigning for it to happen, including from our own savings reporter, George Nixon. That finally happened. But from April, it goes back. So you actually lose some of your own money if you need to access it in an emergency. So you need to know that it is meant to be a pot of cash that you can't touch unless you're buying a home. Or then as a retirement fund. And this is where it gets a little bit confusing for me, Georgie, and why I wouldn't really recommend it for me as part of you're better off just paying into your private pension.
The only difference is, and just to jump in there with the private pension, is if for any reason you do need that money, you know, really, and you're not hopefully dying, the penalty if you take it out of a private pension is enormous. While you'll still have to pay a sort of 6.25% penalty to get your money out of a ISA, that's still more flexible. I'm not saying that's a good, necessarily good thing, and if you're a high rate taxpayer it doesn't necessarily work that way and etc., but there is the flexibility that should you ever essentially need that money, then you do have that option.
I don't know, Georgie. I'm still not convinced. I really am not convinced. I think this was a bit of a harebrained ISA launch, if I'm being quite frank. I really do. Buying it for a home, great. And actually, there's some stats that we've been given from Moneybox, who are now the number one lifetime ISA provider, saying that something like 5,000 people bought a home with their pots in the last sort of 12 months. So, you know, for some people, it is good. It is good, but I would, again, just do your homework and see if you really are adamant that you're going to use your LISA for pension saving. Just have a look. Are you maximising your workplace pension? You know, how much you're putting into your employer's pension? Are they matching it? Are they doubling it? What is your money invested in your pension? This is a whole different podcast of rabbit holes, but it is well worth having a look. But the upshot is, if you're going to buy a home with it, I would definitely think about having a lifetime ISA. Definitely.
I'm absolutely with you on that. I don't think it's certainly not a replacement for a pension, absolutely. But you can see the thinking behind it. Look, people's plans change. Say you've been saving into a lifetime ISA in order to buy a house, and then all of a sudden you get a whopping great inheritance, or you get a house given to you things change. You move in with someone, you don't need to use it. What do you then do with that money? So I can imagine the government or whoever thinks of these things going, okay, well, we can't have people take the money out because then they'll lose the bonus. Why don't we just keep it in there for a little bit longer? So I can kind of get that.
Yeah, but again, Georgia, goalposts can get moved. You know, it's one of these products that I wouldn't be surprised if it gets tinkered with in the future and all of that kind of stuff. Not necessarily saying that it's definitely going to happen, but even with this, with lowering the penalty to 20% from 25%, was all rushed through quite quickly, and now it's going back in despite all the campaigning not to do that. You're right, though. People will just have pots of cash that perhaps they won't fully use for their house deposit and that kind of stuff, but you can only put $4,000, you can only top $4,000 away in it. Yeah, I say only $4,000. But, you know, yeah, again, it's just one of those things. It might be the option for you, but for me, it is not a retirement saving vehicle.
Luckily, I'm just trying to put every point of view across here. But Simon, this debate around ISAs, pensions, all that, you have an article by columnist Tony Hazel, a love letter, I sort of almost think, to ISAs. He's fallen back in love with an ISA after years of it being this poor relation to his pension and his investment portfolio. But what is it that has got Tony's heart all aflutter? And is it a poor relation to a pension? I mean, all ISAs here. I'm not talking about particularly the lifetime ISA.
So what's got Tony falling back in love with his ISA? Tax on his pension, maybe? So to start the start of Tony's column here. I've fallen in love with ISAs all over again. For years, my ISA was the poor relation in my investment portfolio as I piled money into my pension to gain tax relief on contributions. But punitive recent tax changes have taken the gloss off pensions for anyone who saves hard and invests successfully. Those who have built up a sizable pension could stumble into a tax trap, yet this could be sidestepped with the help of ISAs. Earlier this month, Rishi Sunak became the latest chancellor to target the frugal by freezing the lifetime allowance on pensions at £1,078,900 from this April until 2026. Anything above this will eventually face a punitive 55% tax charge. So that's on your growth as well. And the thing, the key is that Tony is Tony's older than me, considerably so. He had a long career in journalism. He's built up a decent pension. He's a smart man, a good investor, and so he's breached his lifetime limit. So the tax charge means that for every £1,000 he makes in his pension, £550 will eventually go in tax. Well, so what can you do? So he says, what's the point of taking risk if the upside is more than halved? So bearing in mind, he's doing a little juggling. Until recently, he kept some cash in both his SIP and ISA and had a rough balance of investments across them. He's gradually moving the focus of the racier investments into his ISA, which now holds very little cash, whereas his pension will lean more towards cash and stodgier investments where I expect slower growth. So to go back to Scottish Mortgage we talked about earlier. One example is Scottish Mortgage, which previously I owned exclusively in my pension and had bought more of last March. This is a lively investment trust holding quite a bit of tech, with Tesla as its largest holding. Its value had doubled over the year and it seemed wise to take some profits, so I sold about a quarter of it. At the start of last week, I decided to buy some back after heavy price falls, but I bought it within my ISA instead. If it booms again, Rishi won't be sharing in the profits. So this is smart. Okay, I told you Tony was smart. Basically, if you've got a pension that's bumping up against that lifetime allowance limit, or if you've got a pension that is at risk of doing that in years to come. And you're also investing in an ISA and you have choices, and people often have choices. You probably want to have a balanced portfolio. You want some racy stuff, some racy, risky, high growth stuff. And you want some nice, steady, stable stuff. Now, if you're going to get walloped by a massive tax charge due to the more growth that you get, do the nice, steady, stable, stodgy stuff in your pension, where there's the risk of that tax charge and you're not going to go so much over it, and put the racy, risky, high growth stuff into your ISA, where it doesn't matter by how much it grows. And this goes back to what I said earlier about thinking about holding a global fund and some cash if you don't want to get your head around the whole bonds thing and you're just starting out with investing. But think about them as one pot. Think about your investments and savings as one pot. We compartmentalize. Lots of behavioral economics has shown the sheer volume of compartmentalizing that people do. And some of it, I think, helps us understand money and helps us understand our lives. But other bits, I think we make mistakes with. And if you're at the stage, you know, that Tony's at, then maybe you should be thinking about your pension and your ISA as one big thing, as like a, right, okay, if I take a little bit from A and put it into B, or I do this with A and I do that with B, maybe that will actually be more beneficial to me over the long term. And so this is the key to why Tony has fallen back in love with his ISA rather than just focusing on his pension. And I think it's a point well made.
Just before we depart, I just want to ask you about ESG very quickly. The pandemic seems to have affected my brain, and I've made my pension and my ISA very ethical, I think. Am I crazy? Am I a woke kind of, I don't know, noodle knitting person?
Are you a fully paid up member of the Wokerati?
I take offence to that, Simon, and I think you should apologise to everybody who is woke. No, not really. I don't know. I just thought maybe I should be doing good with my money. But will I also make a good return, or am I a fool? Is the bubble about to burst? Are we all just getting hyped up in this and really?
Well, before I tell you why I think investing in this way is a good idea, let me also say something that if you think that this time of year, people being encouraged to invest and put money into their ISA is a marketing bonanza, then just wait till you look at the world of ESG and ethical funds. Yeah. Wow, that is a marketeer's dream at the moment. Everything's got an ESG spin on it nowadays and an ethical spin on it nowadays. And if you speak to some people in the investment world who aren't willing to talk publicly about this because it would be like taking out a gun and shooting themselves in both feet, they'll tell you that a lot of this stuff is absolute greenwash and nonsense.
Well, that's what I want to find out.
And that it's a marketing thing, right? Okay, so, I mean, there's been ample stories about funds with an ESG spin that then turn out to have something in them that doesn't look too ESG. Mm-hmm. ESG, environmental, social, and governance. What does that mean? So it's a filter that you put on investments, that they aren't bad for the environment, that they aren't bad for society, and that they have good corporate governance. I would argue that that is one of the most basic filters that you should put on any investment that you choose, regardless of anything. Why you would choose to invest in a company that is bad for the environment, bad for society, or has poor corporate governance is beyond me, right? Because what you are investing in, therefore, is a risk, something that has three big risks attached to it, okay? Because someone's going to come after them for trashing the environment, someone's going to come after them for being bad for society, or the whole thing's going to collapse because it's got bad corporate governance.
But there are some industries surely of themselves that are negative anyway to the environment. Yeah. I mean, but the point of investing via your values is everybody has different values. What is my value?
Ethic? So let's go back to sort of the basics here. When it comes to ethical investing, there's quite a lot of choice, right? Okay. And there's also quite a broad definition of ethical. So there was the classical definition of ethical, which was basically investments that avoided the so-called sin shares, mining, tobacco, oil, stuff that was considered bad, right? Then you've got that morphed into stuff that tried to actively do good as well. You then had this ESG overlayer, which has become a big thing in the investment world and has also become a major thing for institutional investors. And that's why a lot of fund managers are pushing down this route and saying, yeah, we've got an ESG overlay and it's ESG compliant, ESG friendly kind of thing. Because you've got a lot of big institutional investors, pension funds and so on, they've got boards of trustees and they've voted to only invest in things that aren't bad for this stuff or that are purporting to do good. Now, the question is, with some of this ESG stuff, is how much good are these things actually doing, or is it just a spin being put on it? But that is not to say that it is not possible to direct your investments towards stuff that is actively trying to do some good. And that's the other end of it. That's the other end from just avoiding some stuff, going for some stuff that pays a little bit of attention to this, to stuff that can actually make a positive impact or deal with some of the world's problems. So to give an example, I hold an investment trust called Impacts Environmental Markets, right? This invests in companies that focus on products or services that aim to improve our impact on the environment. That could range from a less damaging alternative to cotton. Cotton is hugely damaging to the environment, to a company that does reverse vending machines. So they take in plastic and they pay out money, encourages people to recycle. Companies trying to improve farming through digital technology. Farming is still very, very analog industry, and heavy, heavy overuse of fertilizers is hugely bad for the environment and also terribly bad for the soil and becomes a vicious circle. Now, if you take digital technology, you can understand a little bit more about what's growing, what's doing well, what needs targeting at certain points. You can dramatically reduce the amount of fertilizers that you're using. You can dramatically reduce the amount of water that you're using, and water use is a major issue for the world. So I've chosen to invest in that investment trust because I think that I would like to put my money into companies that are doing something that is quite good. Now, these are profit-driven companies. These are not, you know, not-for-profit organizations that I'm backing here, okay? So I'm under no illusion about the fact that this is capitalism, okay? But as far as I'm concerned, this is a chunk of capitalism that's probably going to make the world better. Now, what's the argument for returns from this kind of stuff? Well, the argument for returns from this kind of stuff is that basically this is exactly what governments are telling us that we have to do, all of this stuff. And governments want the world to do this stuff, but governments do not want to actually do this stuff themselves. They've made it abundantly clear, hands off. They expect private enterprise to do this. There's a wall of money coming at it, but they expect private enterprise to do it. So if you can invest in that long-term trend, then you've got a tailwind behind you, and hopefully you should do well. Now, the big risk is that people are overpaying for this stuff at the moment, and there's a concern about there being a bit of a bubble in the old growth stocks and the tech stocks and the Teslas of this world, where there's a bit of a concern about there being a bubble in this stuff. And some of that crosses over. You know, you might find that some of these firms that invest in companies that are supposedly good for the environment would include Tesla, for example, because it's good for the environment because it's an electric car company. Is making brand new cars good for the environment? I don't know. I'd question that personally. But, you know, it's in some of them. If you want to go looking at this stuff, it's very interesting, but it can be a bit confusing because it's really hard to get a handle on exactly where a fund or trust stands on the whole, not doing bad stuff, paying attention to what companies are doing and making sure they're doing good stuff versus, like, at the other end, actually really making an impact on the world. One place that does have a useful list is Interactive Investor, and it's got its ACE 40, which does three banners: avoids, considers, embraces. Okay, so there's avoiding bad stuff, considering impacts, or embracing making a positive contribution. And, you know, that's worth digging into. Also, just to give some examples of funds and investment trusts that do this, I mentioned Impacts Environmental Markets earlier. There's Baillie Gifford Positive Change Fund. That's very popular. And it's also taken over an investment trust called Keystone and changed that to Baillie Gifford Keystone Positive Change Investment Trust. There's a mouthful. This invests in companies that the managers think will have a positive impact on society or the environment. It could be education, social inclusion, healthcare, the environment. Stewart Investors Worldwide Sustainability is another one. Again, investing in companies that managers think can contribute to the sustainable development of the companies they operate in and make a positive contribution to them. I'm reading that, by the way. Mm-hmm. Renewables Infrastructure Group, that invests in renewable energy, but unlike some renewable energy funds and trusts, it invests in all different types of renewable energy because you find a lot that might be just in solar, just in wind. But again, be careful with some of this renewable energy stuff. People are paying a very high price for it at the moment. And there's another one called Jupiter Green, which invests in companies around the world that have a focus in environmental solutions. Now, I don't know that much about it, but I am interviewing the fund manager on Tuesday, so I can tell you more about it next Friday.
We look forward to it. Lee, I have to say, I didn't think that we would stretch to the 1 hour of talking about ISAs, but never underestimate our ability to talk about, well, interesting things. Lee, before I do put this all to bed and for another season, what are your thoughts generally about sort of ethical stuff?
Ethical investing, I think, is one of those things in which it's a noble cause. It's a good thing to do, to know what your money is invested in. I think a lot of people, especially with things like their pensions, don't actually realise what, you know, A, is being invested in the stock market, and B, what companies are actually making up part of your portfolio, and actually checking those kind of things out. I think a lot of people would be quite surprised as to what their, where their money's going. There's always that argument of, if you're making returns, should you care that much? Well, for some people, that's irrelevant. For some people, they think they want to get into ethical investing, and that's absolutely fine, and I can totally see the arguments for it. I think Simon hit the nail on the head though, is define ethical, and that's the thing.
But it's for you, isn't it? Define ethical. That's why you can't have a set definition, because it's for you. I mean, Facebook, I think, was in one of mine. Facebook, really?
Yeah, but that's it, isn't it? Yeah, yeah. You know, it's really hard.
Sorry.
It's really hard to define ethical. But look, there's more options for people now. It's definitely one of those areas in which the last couple of years has grown out of pretty much nowhere, I would argue, as in more and more people are caring about this, caring about the impact on our planet, and want to know what their money is doing, no matter how small that pot of cash might be in something like your pension or how big. Like anything, I think it's good to have a blend of stuff. I don't know if it's worth, in my mind, going completely 100% down the ethical route, but as in anything, I think it's good just to have a mix of things. Just make sure that you don't have money in a company that you don't agree with. You don't agree with their ethos, whatever that might be. And a lot of companies are making a lot of noise at the moment about becoming more ethical, from oil companies all the way down to social media companies. You know, there's a broad spectrum of companies around this world. It's not the easiest thing to track down sometimes, you know, the green credentials of some of these companies, I would argue. You've got to do your homework. And this is the thing, Georgie, I would argue that some of this stuff takes quite a lot of time. Like, and a lot of things with your personal finances, it takes time to go and go. You have to set aside a weekend, I would argue, and go, right, this is all the money I have in the world. This is my pension. This is my investments, potentially, if you've got them. Here's my savings accounts. Here's what I've got here, there. And what their money is in. And as I say, the big one for it is pensions. And I don't think people quite know what they're invested in. And a lot of the time, it's just a default fund that the company that you work for uses. So go in and have a look. And if you feel confident enough, potentially diversify a bit.
Thank you very much, Lee. Thank you very much, Simon. You can keep up with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk, or you can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast and join in the debate and read comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us. Honestly, right. Well, that's not bad, Lee. Can you do that in a minute?
No.
Don't use your best material.
No.
Right. Okay. We ready? Recording?
Yeah, we're recording. Including that.
So I could cheekily put it in at the end.